So there is something funny which happens in Parshat Bishalach, which we're going to point out right away, and then we'll see what the implications are, what we can do with it. It starts out, and first of all, these are one of those instances where the place that the parsha begins is not the beginning of a chapter. So those of us who don't remember, the chapter beginnings, chapter 13, is not a Jewish thing. It was done by Christian printers. This particular way that we have it is the Archbishop of Canterbury. And it's just interesting that as far as they're concerned, we're in like in the middle of a sentence, and as far as we're concerned, this is a new beginning. V'yi b'shalach paro ta'am. And when Paro sent the people, v'lo nacham elokim derech eretz plishtim, ki karov hu. God didn't want to take them via the land of the Plishtim. Now, I'm not completely convinced that all of you know exactly what that means, but what I want you to imagine, maybe I'll be able to open up a map of Israel and we'll be able to see it. Just give me one second. What Derech Eretz Plishtim means, okay, this should be good. Okay, here. So Derech Eretz Plishtim means to go from Egypt, which is right over here. See Alexandria, Port Said, over here. Going up Derech Eretz Plishtim means to travel up with the water. That's Derech Eretz Plishtim, which means to get from Port Said, again, approximately whatever was there at that point, and then to go straight to Gaza. Right? This is Derech Eretz Plishtim. That's a relatively short way. But instead, they end up going down south. They go this way towards what's today called the Suez Canal. They go towards this way, and that's where they end up getting stuck. And this is most likely where the sea splits, where they end up coursing over into the Sinai desert, which is, somewhat strange, because now the path to get to Israel is going to be much, much longer, and not only will it be longer, they're going to end up going through an entire desert. So if you just think about it, going up the coast is you always have at least some type of water, you always have fish, you always have, certain things that you're going to need. You can bathe in the seawater. But if you go up through the desert, then you're going to be really, not just landlocked, but going through a really incredibly bad climate. I don't know if you realize, but a desert not only is really hot during the day, but it can also really be cold during the night. So that's what this verse is speaking of. If they go Derech Eretz Plishtim, they're in Israel within a couple of days. So if we go back now, when we read the verse, it actually gave us a rationale for this. And it said, again, Vayhi b'shalach paro ta'am, and when Paro sent the people, lo nacham elokim derech eretz plishtim, ki karovu. God didn't let them go by the land of the plishtim because it was too close. Ki amar elokim, God said, peni nachema amrotam milchama v'shorvu mitzrayma. That what's going to happen is they're going to have to then fight for the land of Israel, and then they're going to turn around and go back because they're not going to be ready for war. So that should be something which is really interesting, because God over here is telling us something which we don't always get, and that is God's thoughts on the matter. We're not ready to go into the land of Israel. Now, if you're going to ask me, in some way, can this be perceived as being some foreshadowing that they're going to end up spending so much more time in the desert? Absolutely. Which means there's no reason at this point to say, oh, that's it. They're going to be stuck there for 40 years. But that's the first step towards the 40 years. The first step is the very fact that they are not going the shortest route. They're not going the quickest way. God is already taking them on some type of a detour. And now, second point is, what's the reason for the detour? Because God knows they're not ready to fight. By the time we're going to get to the end of this week's parsha, they're going to be in war. So that's also something that we need to pay attention to. There is a reference, by the way, in this week's parsha that they're going to be there for 40 years. It does say it. And it's a verse that very often is just, you know, sort of skipped over, not noticed. When the man, the manna from heaven, starts to fall, it says, and the Jews will end up eating this for 40 years. So clearly, that's an editorial comment which God dictates to Moshe at the end of the 40 years when the Torah is actually written, and not something which is said straight off. But I'm just saying it's interesting that this idea of the delay is at least twice in the parasha. Once over here and once in terms of the eventual 40 years. But again, because God knows they're not ready for war. And God took them the other way around towards the desert, as you just saw on the map, right? Derech HaMidbar Yamsuf, therefore towards that piece of water, which was more inward, which, again, there is a piece of water there, but they're going to end up getting trapped by it. V'chamushim alu b'nei Yisrael me'eretz Yitzrayim. And the Jews left Egypt. Now, the word that it uses over here is chamushim. And it's really interesting to me because the interpretation, or Rashi's interpretation of chamushim, is very well known. And maybe at some point you heard it. We'll look at it in a second. But what's interesting is, first of all, what the word means. What does it mean to be chamush? What does chamushim mean? So the word actually means that they were armed. Armed with weapons. Which means, in direct contrast to the previous verse, where it says that God knows they're not ready to enter the land of Israel and to fight for it, and they'll get scared by battle, which is, again, these are people who have no military tradition, these people have no military experience, these are people who've been slaves for an incredibly long time, and now they're heading towards the promised land. By the way, there's one more thing to consider. If God really does take them, derech eretz plishtim, forget about the battle, forget about the war, forget about the preparedness. That means if they go up Derech Eretz Plishtim, they never get to Mount Sinai. And isn't one of the things that God said to Moshe at the burning bush is that you have to get to Mount Sinai, which means that, so let's just pause for a moment. I think all of us recognize or should recognize that God could have given us the Torah in Jerusalem with the Beit HaMikdash built already. He could have given us the Torah right then and there. And instead, what's strange is he gives it us in the desert. But God already said to Moshe years before, he said, well, I don't want to exaggerate how long before. He said to Moshe before this, by the burning bush, that when you take them out, you will serve God on this mountain. So therefore, this idea of not going, derech eretz plishtim, going to the mountain, is not only a consideration which is first introduced now, which means it's already part of God's plan long before this. Already from the burning bush, God knows he's not going to let them go derech eretz plishtim because they're not ready to do that. And instead, he's going to be taking them through the desert in order to get to Mount Sinai. So I'm just saying, let's consider that we already had some, you know, if we thought about it, we already had some foreknowledge about this. But as far as the chamushim go, as I said, the simple interpretation is that they were armed. Which means even though God knows they're not ready for war, they think they are ready for war. If you look at Rashi, we have it both in the Hebrew and the English, v'chamushim, ein chamushim ela mizuyanim. It means armed with weapons. And again, I'm not going to read the entire thing over here. It gives us more places. V'chein hu omer v'atem tavru chamushim. When they enter into the land, in the book of Yeshua, it says, you're going to go in chamushim, armed. So therefore, Rashi knows clearly that's what it really means. V'chein tirgimu onkelos mizurazin. And that also means, kimo v'yerket chanichav v'zarez. Zarez means with weapons. So Rashi already gave us two indications that that's what it means. Davar acher, there's another interpretation, which is much more agadic, napshat, midrashic, probably is a better word. Chamushim means echad michamisha, one out of five. Some sources even say one out of 500. Echad michamisha yatsu va'arba chalakim metu b'shloshet mei afela. And during the 3 days of darkness, 4/5 of the Jewish people died. I don't know if you ever heard that teaching. It's actually a very strange teaching. Because if so many people died, first of all, the numbers become even more difficult. If 600,000 leave, and that's just men between the ages of 20 and 60, and then that's only, you know, 1/5 of the people that leave, and the numbers are really that much more, that's an incredible amount of numbers. The second thing is that would totally put a damper on Yetziat Mitzrayim. if you end up losing 80% of your population and only 20% get out, so then there's just something wrong over here in terms of why they would be so happy leaving Egypt. I mean, yes, it's good to get out, but if everybody is burying their dead, then there's something which is very wrong about that. So I'm just saying is that Rashi quotes this interpretation. It's not a simple interpretation, A, in terms of the essence of it, that most Jews died during the days of darkness. And the ones, by the way, the continuation of that, the ones that left are the ones who were righteous. But more than that, it's not what the word means. It's not what chamushim means. The word chamushim means they left armed. And if you go back to the context, that's exactly what it's saying. Pasuk Yud-Tet, 19. V'yikach Moshe et atzmot Yosef imo. And at first glance, this looks like a non sequitur. Okay, and when they left, now it goes on to a new topic. And when they left, Moshe kept this vow that the Jewish people had made, the continuation of the verse, because Moshe, Yosef, at the very, very end of Sefer Bereishit, had made the Jewish people vow and say that when you leave, when God remembers you, when God remembers you and takes you out of here, when you leave, I want to leave with you. So we spoke about this previously, at least one time, that Yosef, who could have taken his part as part of the pantheon of leaders of Egypt, he could have asked for a beautiful pyramid to be built for him, as many of the Egyptians, they were really into death. But Yosef says, no. Yosef says, I'm a Jew. When you leave, I want to go with you. And God will take you out. There will be a redeemer. There will be a redemption. You are going to leave, and I want to go with you. So as we read these first couple of verses of Bishalach, so we just learned that it's so much more complicated than we would have imagined. There was a quick way to go, but God knows they're not ready for that. That why they're not ready? Because then they're going to have to fight. And if they have to fight, God says, I know they're not ready. But the Jews think they're ready, and they take their weapons with them. What kind of weapons could they take? So clearly they have primitive weapons. What do they have? What do you think they have? They have sticks, they have bows and arrows. And that's why, as we continue in the Parsha, and Egypt is suddenly manifest with, and they had tanks of the day. What do I mean by tanks? They had all these chariots, which means they have these chariots which are moving very quickly, which have arms on them, and the Jews have sticks, and the Jews maybe have bows and arrows, which means just like in a conventional war today, if one side had maybe handguns and maybe rifles, but the other one has tanks, then it makes it a very uneven fight. And that's part of what's going on over here, is that the fight itself, even though we may be willing, God knows that this is going to be, in terms of natural terms, going to be exceedingly difficult for us to be victorious. But I do want to go back to this issue. But Moshe takes Yosef's remains. And again, first glance, this has nothing to do with anything. And it's just part of an old promise that Moshe is keeping to his great uncle. I have pointed out along the way, again, last number of weeks, I have pointed out that there probably by this point is a special affinity between Moshe and between Yosef, both of them being brought up in the palace, having something more in common than we ever would have imagined, that Moshe knows what it was like to be Yosef, and Moshe knows to what extent Yosef really was a tzaddik, to keep his identity, just like Moshe ends up keeping his identity as a Hebrew, as a Jew. And the fact that the two of them are leaving means that despite assimilation, again, just think about the assimilation that exists in the world today, where, by the way, we could go to numbers getting close in many countries to 80%. If you think about that midrash, then that 80% are lost, and you look at the numbers today in many parts of the world where 80% are lost. So here you have two Jews who would have every reason to have been completely assimilated because they were just part of the Egyptian, not just country, not just culture. They were a part of the very epicenter of that leadership in living and growing up in the palace. And the fact that they end up leaving and that Moshe takes Yosef with him, I just don't think that that irony should be lost. And it's more than irony, that connection between the two of them should be lost upon us, because I think that it actually, when we think about it, makes a great deal of sense. We're then told something in the Mechilta, which I think turns everything on its head. And this is going to help us for the rest of what we're going to talk about today. The Mechilta is a very old source. There are two types of midrash. There is something which is called midrash halacha, and there's something which is called Midrash Agada. So I think most of the time when we read Midrashim, we're reading Midrash Agada. What exactly is Midrash Halacha? It's when the Midrash, it's sort of like the Mishnah, but it's connected to the verses. So over here, the Midrash Halacha, which is called the Mechilta, teaches us something which I really think is quite surprising and something that, again, we would not necessarily have thought about this on our own, because it just seems so improbable and so, I don't know what to call it, perhaps we can call it disconnected from everything else that we've been reading. But I'm going to start off by saying the way that I was reading these verses, which seemed correct to me, by reading that the Jews thought they're ready to fight, and then Moshe takes Yosef's remains, and that has nothing to do with one another. Well, the Mechilta says, well, guess what? This actually does have far more to do with one another than you can possibly imagine. And let's read the Mechilta. Shimon ish Kitron Omer, and I'll tell you, here's a person who we really don't know that much about him. It's not the kind of person who speaks a lot in the Gemara and the Mishnah. Shimon ish Kitron Omer, Bizchut atzmot she Yosef, ani korea lahem et hayam. That the reason the sea is splitting is because of the remains of Yosef. Shenemar v'yazov bigdo etzla v'yanasa chutza. That he left his clothing by her and he ran outside. Uktiv hayam ra'ah. The sea saw something. Vayanas, and then the sea ran to two sides, and that's how it split. Essentially, what this Shimon Ish Kitron is doing is he's noting that the word vayanas, which means to run away, is used in the narrative of Yosef running away from Mrs. Potiphar, and it's used describing the sea when it runs away, as it were, from itself, and it splits down the middle, and each side runs to the banks of the river, and then we have dry land in the middle. So this is a really interesting comment, because what it's saying is that when the Jews go through the sea, and again, they're completely frightened, Egypt is closing in on them, and they're about to die because of the whole incredible Egyptian war machine with their tanks, with the chariots, and so on. And then they end up miraculously finding the sea splits in front of them. And as it happens, okay, because God made a promise and so on and so forth. God said he's going to save us and don't worry about it. And we prayed and all the other reasons in the world that you would think that God should save us. And then it says, no, I'll tell you the real reason that they're being saved. The real reason is because Yosef's remains were with them. Which means as much as all the Jews are chamushim taking weapons with them, they had one secret weapon that they may not have even understood was ultimately the thing which is going to cause them to be victorious. And that ultimate weapon was the remains of Yosef. And that is something which I think needs to be much better understood. So let me try and to explain it like this. And first of all, if any of us ever have to speak by a Sheva Brachot. It could be that we don't like to give Divrei Torah, we don't like to speak. But one of the things that it says in the Gemara about marriages, about Shiduchim, this terrible, terrible concept of a Basheret, right? It's one of the worst things in Jewish thought, that there is a Basheret. There's one special person. There's probably a lot to talk about that. But one of the things that it says is, one opinion is, that God makes these arrangements long before people are born. God puts two souls together. And it's responded in the Talmud with a second opinion saying, what are you talking about? That to make shiduchim, to put people together, is as difficult as splitting the sea. So you have to ask yourself, you know, a question. For God, splitting the sea is not difficult. For God, splitting the sea, I mean, for God, why would anything be difficult? So why, and more importantly, why would that be the comparison? Oh, that's as hard as splitting the sea. So splitting the sea essentially is asking something to go against nature, right? Nature is a sea is together. Naturally, a sea doesn't split. But by the way, the actual description of the splitting of the sea in the Torah is far less miraculous in its perception. The splitting of the sea, I want to be very careful. The splitting of the sea is not described in a miraculous way. The splitting of the sea, it says that a wind blew the entire evening, and then in the morning it was split. The miraculous part was not the splitting. Anybody who was watching that, right? If it would have been the front page of Haaretz, it would have been, wow, the Jews got really lucky because this wind came and blew and this natural phenomenon took place and the sea split. The miraculous was not the splitting of the sea. And then they go walk into the other side. And then the Egyptians walk through because there's dry land over there. The miraculous part is when Moshe lifts up his hand the second time and then all the water returns and kills all the Egyptians. The miraculous part about the splitting of the sea is not when we go through it, because that looked, the wind blew all night and then there was no water. Rather, it was the dramatic ending of the splitting of the sea. That was the part which was far more miraculous, at least to the eye. I mean, we all know the most important part of a miracle is the timing. And right as we had our backs to the water, we were in a peninsula. There was no way out. The Egyptians were coming at us. And at that moment, the wind blows. And then we look in the morning, there's dry land. And we have a place to go while we were trapped the night before. So the miracle is the timing of that wind. But the really blatant miracle that took place was the ending of the splitting of the sea, more so than the splitting of itself. Nonetheless, what does this have to do with the marriage? What does it have to do with people meeting one another? Ultimately, what, if we go back to Yosef, what did Yosef do? Because that's what this Rav Shimon Kitron taught, that because of Yosef, the sea was split. What did Yosef do? Yosef went against nature. Because what is nature? Nature, to a very great extent, is instinct. Over here, you have a 17-year-old being hit upon by a woman, just for argument's sake, I'll say a beautiful woman, a powerful woman, a woman who says, listen, I can make your life much better for you. He works in her house, and she's essentially saying to him, you'll make me happy, I'll make you happy, and then you can start with being young and hormones and whatever else you want to throw on top of this. But Yosef goes against a natural inclination. He goes against his natural desires and he walks out of that room. Vayanas, he runs out of the room. So therefore, when the sea is split, what is he saying? Is that because Yosef went against his nature, that's why the sea ended up going against its nature and ended up being split. So what does it have to do with getting married? Essentially, people are very, I hate to say this, but naturally, we are all very self-absorbed. We're very self-involved. We care about ourselves. It really, when it comes down to it, is somewhat miraculous that we're able to take our narcissism and place it on the side and to say, I want to take another person in my life. And ultimately, what I'm going to do is I'm going to stop thinking in terms of my internal thoughts about I or me. I'm going to start thinking instead about us or we. Which means that that very basic shift of a person not only looking out for themselves, but rather taking another person in their life, that they are just, their self-perception now is we, it's us. And, you know, there's a beautiful, very often quoted story from someone who is known as the Tzaddik of Yerushalayim, or Aryeh Levine. If you find in the library the biography about him, called A Tzaddik in Our Time, sit and read it. It's probably the most important book that you can read in terms of appreciating Jewish values. And it says that once his wife didn't feel well, her leg hurt, and he took her to the doctor, and the doctor, what's the matter? And Aryeh Levine said to the doctor, my wife's foot hurts us. The us was, she's in pain, but we're both in pain. Why are we both in pain? Because her foot hurts. So to be able to get to that point, to totally feel somebody else's pain, that's part of this miraculous of going against human nature. Because unfortunately, we look at ourselves far more than we look at other people. So over here, the sea splits. I'm going to say it again. Because of Yosef, it ends up splitting. And therefore, as much as the Jews had all of their weapons with them, ultimately, those weapons didn't help. Now, along the way, all kinds of things are going to happen in this week's parasha. Most of them are going to do, again, once we get past the Egyptians, are going to end up dealing with supplies. We're not going to have water, and then we don't have food. We don't have water, God provides water. We don't have food, God provides food. We don't have water again, so God provides water again. And along the way, we should essentially learn a lesson, and that is that God has taken us for a ride over here. The ride is going through the desert. In the desert, there are no supplies, and I want to go back. Had we gone through Derech Eretz Plishtim, up the coast, there would have been much more resources to have used. We could have been more self-sufficient. Apparently, part of the lesson over here is that lesson of we on a national level. One of the beautiful descriptions of going into the desert is where God says that Zacharti lechesed ne'urayach, right? Avak lolotayach. I remember when we left, we were like lovers, and lechtech acharei b'midbar be'eretz lo zerah. You followed me off into the desert in a place that nothing grew. There was nothing growing over there, where there were no natural resources. So therefore, God describes Am Yisrael's following him into the desert really as a love story, while we went there. And again, all of this is the background of Parshat B'Shalach. But once we go there, then we have no supplies. We have no supplies, and we have to trust God. And that's essentially going to, lesson is going to be, we need water. We have to lift our heads to heaven and say, God, we need water. And we need food. We have to lift our heads to heaven and say, God, we need food. And essentially, having bread fall from heaven is that exact message, which means today we sometimes get deluded. Where does food come from? So maybe some of you actually think that food comes, what are those meal things that you have? What are those called? The
vouchers.
The vouchers. You say, where does food come? Food comes from vouchers. Where do the vouchers come from? Oh, vouchers come, I don't know exactly who they come from. They come from Rabbi Benagid? No. Where do the vouchers come? Oh, your parents paid for them. Well, but where do the vouchers come? Which means, ultimately, for us today, it takes us a little bit of time, but we need to realize that when it comes down to it, food comes from God, comes from heaven. And it was so much easier then, because you lifted up your eyes and you see the man coming down, and food comes from heaven. Food comes from God. And, you know, today when we eat it, we need to stop a second. You need to focus a second. You need to think a second. You need to make a bracha. We need to say, Baruch Ata Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam Hamotzi Lechem Min Haaretz, that even though it came from the ground, it was God who did it. There's a whole discussion, what bracha did they make on the food that came from heaven? And some say, they said, Hamotzi Lechem Min Hashamayim, that blessed is God who gave us food from heaven, even though I'm going to say ultimately all food comes from heaven. But that's the rest of this week's parsha, is that we constantly have this problem. We need things, we need resources, and God provides them with us. But we keep falling backwards, and eventually, again, we're going to move towards the end of the parsha, and we get to this next episode. In chapter 17, Perek Yud Zayin, we had no water. And once again, we start to fight and we start to complain and Moshe and so on. And this is where God says to Moshe, take your staff, hit the rock. And he hits the rock. Again, this time God says, hit the rock. And it ends up by saying, Vayikreshem ha-makom Masa u'miriva. And the name of this place was Masa u'miriva. Masa, and Miriva means to fight. Masa u'miriva could be this place of conflict. Al riv b'nei Yisrael, because of the fight that the Jews had, va'al nasotam et Hashem, and how they tested God, Lamor, saying, Hayesh Hashem b'kirbeinu emayin, is God among us or not? So therefore, we get to this point again, that despite the miracles, despite that they ate man for breakfast that morning, they still question, because they didn't have water, they question if God even exists, and if God exists, is God with them? And this questioning of God has a terrible implication, because what happens when we question God's existence? Pasuk Chet, v'yavo Amalek. Amalek arrived. V'ylachemim Yisrael b'refidim. And they went and they fought against the Jews in Refidim. So as much as the beginning of the parasha told us that God didn't take us derech Eretz Plishtim, he doesn't take us in the shorter way, because lest we see war and go back to Egypt. And then he takes us through the sea, and through the sea, God ends up fighting. And the merit, of course, we said, is Yosef. Now suddenly we find ourselves at war. So that's one of the ironies of the parsha. We go this longer way to avoid war, and then war found us, which is, again, one of the problems in Jewish history. We may try to avoid conflict, but we have not always been successful in avoiding conflict, and conflict found us. If you've never heard about the Khmelnytsky massacres, where according to estimations, 600,000 Jews were killed in the 1600s, and it was simply because we got caught between two different sides in a conflict. We were not on either side. We had nothing to do with the fight, but we got caught in the middle. And again, more than 500,000 Jews ended up being killed in that fight. And by the way, this guy, Khmelnytsky, is seen till today as a Polish hero. And they have all kinds of statues in his memory and so on. And I'll say it again, he would have killed 6 million had he had enough resources to have done this. He tried to get rid of every single Jew who was there. And if you've never heard of this, this is one of these things that we really do need to learn and do need to understand history. as much as the Holocaust, and today, by the way, is International Holocaust Remembrance Day, as much in the larger world, as much as the Holocaust is seen as a singular event, it's singular in terms of scope, but it's not like no one ever tried before. There were other attempts. And speaking of which, Amalek comes. Amalek comes, I mean, for no reason. We're not near their land. We, again, generally, why do wars take place? There has to be some kind of a reason that causes this to happen. Amalek suddenly arises. They heard that we're there. That was enough reason for them to come. V'yavo Amalek. They come to meet us. They come to fight us. V'yilachem Yisrael b'refidim. V'yoma Moshe el Yehoshua. And Moshe says to Yehoshua, b'char lenu anashim, choose men. V'tzei yilachem Amalek, and go fight Amalek. So again, as much as we tried to avoid war, war found us. And now Moshe turns to, of all the people of Am Yisrael, he turns specifically to somebody named Yehoshua. Now, again, there may be some foreshadowing over here, because Yehoshua is eventually going to be the one who is going to lead the Jews into the land of Israel, right? We're not going Derech Eretz Plishtim because it's too close, but the guy who will lead us when we eventually go in will be Yehoshua, so that's interesting. And he says, "V'tzei lechem b'malek, and go fight against Amalek. Machar, anochi nitzav arosh ha-givah. Tomorrow, I will go up to the top of the hill. U'matei lukim biyadi. I'm going to have in my hand the staff of God." By the way, those of you who remember from the Chad Gadya, there's something, there's a stick there in the story, a chutra. The Targum always translates mate as chutra. He's taking the staff of God in his hand. Vayas Yehoshua kasher amar lo Moshe lilachem b'malek. Moshe obeys, sorry, Yehoshua obeys that which Moshe had told him to fight against the Malek. Umoshe Aharon v'chur. So I want you to pay attention now. There's Moshe, there's Aharon, there's a guy named Chur, and there's Yehoshua. So we have four heroes, or four protagonists. Yehoshua is down below fighting. Moshe goes up. Umoshe Aharon v'Chur alu rosh agiva. And Moshe Aharon and Chur go up. So these four people, first question I'm going to ask, do we ever see these four people isolated from the rest of Am Yisrael in any other time, in any other story? And you know already, if I ask that question, then the answer is yes. The question is when. There's one time which it clearly says in the text, and there's a second time which is inferred certainly by Midrashim. But before I give you the answer to this, Vayakashe Yarim Moshe Yado, when Moshe lifts his hands heavenward, again pointing to people to pray to heaven, Vagavar Yisrael, because Sheniach Yado Vagavar Amalek. But if people lose that focus that they need to lift their heads heavenwards, then Amalek will be stronger. Vide Moshe Kvedim. And Moshe's arms were heavy from pointing up to heaven. V'chu Evan, and on his two sides are Arad and Chor, and they're supporting him. And they take a stone, v'yisimu tachta, v'yeshev aleh, and then Moshe sits, v'arun v'chor tamchu biyadav, and Arad and Chor hold up Moshe's hands. So now if I have to ask you, who are Arad and Chor? So the quick, short answer to this is, they are Moshe's right and left hand men. They are the people who support him. Tamchu biyadav mizeh achad mizeh achad. They support his arms, this from one side, that from the other side. V'yihi yadav emunah ad bo ha-shemesh. And his hands are hands of faith until the sun will come. So this is also really interesting, this combination of things. You know, again, we're down below, there are people fighting. Who's fighting? They're being led by Yehoshua. Why Yehoshua? We still don't know yet. And as much as the people are fighting and thinking they're being victorious because of their own fighting, the reality is that something else is taking place on top of the mountain, and that is the prayers of Moshe, and Moshe's arms lifting and all the people heavenward, or their eyes heavenward, is what actually is winning. But the thing which is supporting Moshe are the arms, in turn, of Aharon and Hur, and they're the ones who are helping him. And Moshe needs this support. V'chalosh Yehoshua et Amalek. Yehoshua weakens Amalek, ve'etamo l'ficharev, and he weakens them by using the sword. Vayomar Hashem Moshe, and God says to Moshe, k'tov zot zikaron b'sefer, write this down as a memorial in a book, v'simba uznei Yehoshua, and make sure that the message is internalized by the ears of Yehoshua. So it's also interesting that Yehoshua is going to be the one, not Moshe. Which means, again, I have some foreshadowing that when they actually go to war and go to Israel, Yehoshua is going to lead them. Ki mocha'em ched ze'ach ha'melech mitachat ha'shamayim. And let Yeshua know that I will get rid of Amalek, which means ultimately the destruction of Amalek is going to be by God, but somehow Yeshua is going to partner in that, and we don't know why. V'even Moshe Mizbeach v'kosh Shema Hashem Nisi, and Moshe built an altar and said, God tested me, which is interesting because right before all this, the people tested God by questioning his existence. V'yomer ki yad al kes ya, that God makes a vow by his throne. But notice the word kes and not kisei. Milchama l'Hashem b'Amalek, dor dor. That God will be involved in a war against Amalek forever. Rashi notes, based on Chazal, ki yad al kesya, yado shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God lifts his hand, which is interesting, like Moshe had lifted his hand, now God lifts his hand. Hurma lishava b'kiso, and God swears by his throne in heaven, liyot lo milchama ve'ivaba Amalek olamit, that there'll be war and hatred against Amalek forever. Umahu kis velo nemar kise, and why is throne or chair written deficiently without the aleph at the end? Ve'af Hashem nimchat lechetziav, and why is God's name yud-hei al kisya and not yud-hei vav-hei, God's name written imperfectly? Nishva Kadosh Baruch Hu she'in shemo shalem, that God's name is not complete, because as long as Amalek in Kisei Shalem, and God's throne is not complete, Ad Shimcheh Shemo Shel Amalek Kulo, until Amalek is destroyed, which means Amalek is this thing, this being, this thought, this nation, that rejects God's kingship on this earth. And as long as they're around to attack God's kingship is not completely manifest until humanity recognizes it. And when Amalek is erased, then God's name will be whole, Vakisei Shalem, and his throne will be whole. So, let me go back and regroup for a second, see that you know where we are, how we got here, and where we're still going. We started the parsha, and we're trying to avoid war. The people, though, either out of complete naivete or out of a false sense of self, believe that they have the arms to fight. God knows they don't. And instead of taking the short way where they have to fight, he takes them the long way. They think their arms are going to be victorious, but it's actually the remains of Yosef is victorious. When throughout the parsha they have needs, basic food, water, the needs are met by God, because I'll say it again, they didn't go in this area, in this place where they could have had resources. Instead, they go in this direction where they have no resources and have to trust in God. So that's really the issue, is going to be to what extent they trust in God, they'll be victorious. Amalek represents the lack of belief in God, and therefore when they don't believe in God, and they say, hold it, does God even exist? When they run into a little difficulty of not having water to drink, at that point Amalek suddenly emerges, which means Amalek is this thing which is connected to lack of belief, and Amalek then comes and attacks them. Then, and this is the part we need to get to, and then we notice something. Of all the people around, Moshe turns to Yehoshua and says to Yehoshua, you're the one who should go and gather men and fight against Amalek. Moshe, for his part, goes up to the mountain, but he takes two people with him, Aaron and Hur. So let's start with the easier one to understand. Aaron is the easiest one to understand. Aaron has been with Moshe from the beginning. And maybe there's another element. And that is, the day will come very soon that Aharon will be revealed as being the Kohen Gadol. Which means if Moshe, who represents Malchut, to a certain extent, Moshe is the leader, or for that matter, Moshe really represents Torah. Moshe is Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe is the one who very, very soon, next week's parasha, Yitro, is going to climb up the mountain again. And then when he climbs up the mountain next week, he's going to end up bringing down the Torah from heaven. Which means Moshe represents Torah. Aaron is on his side, and let's make it up now and say he's on his right-hand side, and Aaron represents the kohuna, the Kohen service of God, and therefore Aaron's with him. So part of our mystery now will be the two other protagonists. One is why Yoshua is chosen, and he's the one who's down below fighting. And the other protagonist, who we are mystified about, is Hur. And Hur is Moshe's either right-hand or left-hand man, and he's there as well. Now, if we go back, we'll learn a couple of interesting things about these two people. One, in Perikof Dalid, which describes Moshe about to go up to Mount Sinai for 40 days and 40 nights, there it says, Vayakam Moshe v'Yoshua mishartu. And here we learn that who is Yoshua? Yoshua is actually Moshe's right-hand man. He's his misharet. He's the person who helps him. He was actually, of all people, the one who's closest to Moshe in terms of always being there to help him, to serve him, to be there for him. He's the one that Moshe entrusts, but we still don't know enough about him. Ad asher nashuv aleichem, and to the elders, he says, you know, everybody wait over here. V'hine Aharon v'chur imachem, mi bal dvarim yigash aleichem. And Moshe says, Aaron and Hur, I'm going to leave as your leaders, and whoever has any issues, any questions, any things they need dealt with, go over to them. Which means the same four people, Moshe, Yoshua, Aaron, and Hur, are also identified when it comes to Matan Torah. Now, after Matan Torah, something else happens, and that is the Chet HaEgel, the sin of the golden calf. The sin of the golden calf takes place when Moshe is not with him because Moshe is up on the mountain. Yehoshua goes halfway up the mountain with him and waits for him, and when Moshe actually comes down, he meets Yehoshua, and he hears all of the celebrations. He hears the rave going on below, which is known as the golden calf, and they're partying, and all kinds of things are going on. Now, if we backtrack a little bit, what the Gemara tells us is that when Moshe was gone, they start to get very anxious. If Moshe's not here, you know, how are we going to survive? So it says in the Gemara that they then turn to Hur, and they say to Hur, build for us an egel. And Hur says, over my dead body. And they say, fine. And they execute Hur. Then it says, Aaron sees they killed Hur. And Aaron says, you know what? Better than they kill Hur and me in the same day. And for that, who knows if the Jews would ever be forgiven. I'll help them. I'll facilitate this. I'll have the sin on me rather than this fall upon the Jewish people. Which means now when we ask, so what happened to Hur? So the answer is, it's really fascinating. Because over here, we're told that if there's any issues, go talk to Hur. And we never see him again. Hur never appears again. Any issues go to Hur and Aaron. So we know what happened with Aaron. Where was Hur? So that's the rabbinic read on the text, that Hur tried to fight them off and they killed him. Now, to understand exactly who it is that they killed or what it was that they had done, or maybe we'll put it this way, how bad it is what they did. So if we look in source number 7, there's a guy named Bezalel. Bezalel has a street named after him, Jerusalem. Bezalel has an art school named after him, Bezalel School of Arts. Why? Because he was the architect to build the Mishkan. Re'e karati b'shem Bezalel ben Uri ben Hur l'mate Yehuda. The one who's going to build the Mishkan is a grandson of the same Hur, and now you realize who Hur is. Hur is from Yehuda. Hur is the man who was supposed to be king, which means the kingship of David HaMelech runs through the tribe of Yehuda. One of the people it was supposed to go through was Hur, which means standing on that mountain, if we go backwards now, Yehoshua, and we still need to figure that out, Yehoshua is down below fighting, but up on the mountain is Moshe who represents Torah. On the one hand is the man who will be the Kohen Gadol, and the other hand is the man who will be king. Which means they killed the person who would be king, and not just any king. This is the person that Malchut ben David is going to come from. This is the person who would have been, I don't know how strong to put this, would have been Mashiach. It's his grandson, it's the Ben Hur, right, who ends up building the Mishkan. It is the Ben David, Shlomo, who builds the Beit HaMikdash, and it is a Ben David who will one day be Mashiach, which means if you now pay attention to the line, and the truth is, paying attention to the line genealogy is generally less important in the book of Shemot than it will be in Bamidbar. But you almost can't understand anything taking place in the book of Bamidbar without paying attention to which tribes are we talking about over here. Which means, over here we have Moshe and Aaron. They're brothers. They're from the same tribe. But one represents Torah, that's Moshe. The other represents the Kuhuna, the Kohen, and that is Aaron, which means you have that distinction right now. And the other one, Hur, represents Yehuda. And as we know, the way that the book of Bereshit ended with Yehuda being anointed as king, this is it. This is Hur. So if now you ask, well, so what happened? Why didn't Hur become king? And the answer is because they killed him when he tried to act as king. The person who couldn't take that was Aaron, who said, no, this could be catastrophic. And by the way, later on, there was a prophet known as Zechariah who tried to stop the people from sinning in the Beit HaMikdash, and they murdered him in the Beit HaMikdash. So the murder of a Navi, of Zechariah, in the Beit HaMikdash, that's one of the things that the Midrashim, the Agadot, then tell us, that when the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, they saw his blood boiling up on the grounds, and he ended up killing all kinds of people in order to avenge the blood of this Navi who was killed in the, literally, that's, it says it in the Navi, in the courtyard of the Beit HaMikdash, he was killed. So now we realize that we're capable of such things, that somebody can come over and tell us, listen, you're not behaving properly, so we can either do one of two things. You know what? You're right. We need to fix this. Or we can say, who are you to tell us how to behave, and go and murder him? And that's what they did, which means that, I guess, people, rabbis, need to be really, really careful when it is that we tell people how to behave, because Am Yisrael cannot always appreciate this or accept this or be able to internalize this. And we go back to this victory against Amalek, and now we realize it's Moshe surrounded by Malchut and the Kohen Gadol in potential. That's who they should become. One does and the other doesn't. And we realize that path is complicated. But of course, there was one other person. And the one other person who we need to figure out about is, and that's Yehoshua. So let's get back and understand a little bit more about Yehoshua, then I think that everything will fall into focus. In source number 8, which is in Bamidbar, and here it's in Bamidbar, this is actually the introduction to the story about the spies, Ulamate Ephraim, Hoshea bin Nun. And when it came to Mate Ephraim, the person who was chosen as the spy to represent that tribe of Ephraim was a man named Hoshea bin Nun. This is the same Yehoshua. How do we know? Right afterwards it says, Vikra Moshe, Hoshea bin Nun, Yehoshua. And Moshe calls him Yehoshua. And I want you to notice something, because hopefully, you know, we can't miss this, that his name is Hoshea, but when you put the Yud there, then his name becomes Yehoshua, which now has three of the four letters of God's name. Remember, one of the things that we heard is that God's throne is not complete and his name is not complete as long as Amalek is in the world. So Yehoshua, who gets a little bit more of God's name in him, he's the one who ends up being chosen. By the way, in the Beit HaMikdash, on the breastplate of the Kohen Gadol, or Al HaShoham, Hayakatuv, Yehosef. Yosef is written Yud He Vav instead of the normal Yosef, which means there's also a Yud He Vav, three quarters of God's name. And those of you who haven't figured this out yet, Yehoshua is from Ephraim. Ephraim is from Yosef, which means both in the Beit HaMikdash, on the breastplate, which is worn by the Kohen Gadol, you have a more complete name. Instead of Yosef, the He is put there, giving a Yud He Vav, and Yehoshua, the man who's going to fight against Amalek, and the purpose there is to make God's name whole, to make God's throne whole, in order to make God manifest in this world. Moshe gives him an extra letter, which therefore makes it a little bit closer, Yud He Vav, Yehoshua, instead of just Hoshea. And Yehoshua, of course, is from Yosef. Now, something else just now happened, if you haven't realized. We started the parasha by saying that the people brought their primitive weapons with them to fight, but Moshe took something else with him. What did Moshe take with him? Moshe took the remains of Yosef. And the remains of Yosef is what allowed us to be victorious against the Egyptians, and that's what allowed the sea to split, which means it was the merit of Yosef, Vayanas, right, who ran out of the room, and Vayanas Hayam, and the sea split. It saw something, and then it ran away, and it splits, is that it's Bizchut Yosef is why the Jews are actually, at the end, they are saved in the first story. Now we realize that the tribe which was chosen to go and to leave the fight is, of course, Yoshua coming from Yosef as well. And that's not just a coincidence, which means Moshe understood both in the beginning of the parasha and understands over here as well that there's something about Yosef which is able to lead us to victory. So now we still need to try to understand what it is that Moshe understands. One, look at Ovadia. Ovadia, by the way, it's a book in the Navi. If any of you want to take 20 minutes today, you can learn the whole book. It's one chapter. Truth is, it won't take you 20 minutes. It'll take you 5 minutes. And now we'll read one of the, I forgot exact how many, but not all that many verses. You're on your way. Vayabet Yaakov Esh, Uvet Yosef Lahava. And the house of Yaakov will be a fire, but Yosef will be the flame. Uvet Esav Lakash. And the house of Esav will be the kash. Now, what exactly is kash? Kash is the straw. Vidolku behem vachlum. And they'll set them on fire and swallow them. V'lo yesarid lebeit Esav ki Hashem diber. And nothing will remain, and God has spoken. Which means what? Yaakov will be victorious one day against Esav. Completely victorious. But which part of Yaakov will allow, which one of his sons, if you want, will actually be the flame to burn the straw? And straw, by the way, burns very easily. What will be the flame? And now we're told the flame is actually Yosef. And that, of course, needs to be understood. When Yaakov runs away from his brother because he's afraid he's going to kill him, at what moment does he decide he's able to go back? So look at Source 11, chapter 30. Vatar v'teled ben, Rachel has a son, v'toma asaf elokim et cherpati. Right, God has taken away my embarrassment. V'tikrat shmo Yosef, and she names him Yosef Lemor, saying, Yosef Hashem li ben acher, let God bless me with another child. V'yi kasher yalda Rachel et Yosef, and as soon as Yosef is born, v'yomer Yaakov v'Lavan, Yaakov says to Lavan, shlacheni, let me go, v'chel mekomi l'artzi, let me go back home, let me go back to my people, back to my land, back to where I come from. Which means at that moment he's no longer afraid. Rashi understood this exactly. Mishenolad, in source 12, Satno shel Esav, the Satan of Esav, the adversary of Esav is in the world. Yosef is in the world, or for some of you, Yosef is in the house. Once Yosef is born, Yaakov no longer has to be afraid of Esav. Now he can go back home. Yosef is just born. And he quotes that verse that we just now saw in Ovadia. The moment Yosef was born, now he knew, now he had no questions, now he can go back. In order to put really the whole parasha in a way that we can understand it, I want to read together with you, and here I apologize, it's not in English. If anybody wants to type up the English as I translate, that would be great. Otherwise, I'll have to do it. It's a source called Psikta. The Psikta is, you know, I mentioned earlier Midrash Halacha, Midrash Agadah. The Psikta is connected to various special holidays and Torah readings. This is the Psikta for Parshat Zachor. What's Parshat Zachor? It's what we read when we want to remember the war that Amalek attacked us. Davar Acher. Lama mar Moshe li Yoshua tzei lachem. Why did Moshe choose Yoshua? Neshahu mi b'nei b'nei shel Rachel. Because he, and it starts off by saying he's descendant of Rachel. Asher korcha baderech, v'iznev v'cha kol enecha shalim acharecha, v'lo yir Elokim. Because as it says in Parshat Zachor, we were in the desert, and we stumbled, and we didn't fear God. So therefore, what is he saying? What's between the lines here? We needed somebody who really, truly feared God. Davar acher, lama Esav nofel biyad Yosef, ela Yosef katan ben zakunim, ve'esav inei katan netaticha begoyim. Because Yosef is the young, one of the younger, one of the smaller of the nations, And Esav, we're being told, and again, quoting from Ovadia. Now you realize the whole book of Ovadia is about the loss of Esav. Yavo Esav HaKatan, Shekarati Vipol B'Yad Yosef HaKatan. That Esav is going to fall to the hands of Yosef. Davar Acher. Kol HaShvatim Nishtatfu B'Michirato Shel Yosef. All of the tribes together conspired in the sale of Yosef. Lefichach Ein Echad Min HaShvatim Yachol Hizdaveglo. Therefore, none of the other tribes who were involved in the sale of Yosef have the ability. We don't understand this yet. Davar acher, Esav haya bachor, umasim ra'im. Esav was the firstborn, but his actions were terrible. Ibed et bechorato. He lost the status as firstborn. Yosef, hu haya katan. Yosef was younger than his other brothers, than most of them. Umasim tovim, but his deeds were good. Zachal lebechora. He therefore ended up receiving the role of the firstborn. That Yosef, in his good deeds, end up being able to defeat Esav, who ends up having bad deeds. More. Yosef gadal ben shnei rishaim. Yosef grew up surrounded by two wicked people, ben Potiphar uParo. Well, maybe it's Potiphar and Eshet Paro, could be as well. V'lo lamad mimaseim. But he didn't learn from their deeds. Esav gadal ben shnei tzadikim. Esav was raised by two righteous people, Yitzchak and Rivka, v'lo limad mimaseim, and he didn't learn from them. Amakadosh Baruch Hu Yovei Yosef shekadal ben shnei rishaim, v'lo limad mimaseim v'yifram min Esav shelo limad mimaseim. And therefore, on a moral level, Yosef is able to defeat Esav. Davar acher, another interpretation. Yavo Yosef sheshileim la'achav tova tachat ra'a, v'esav shileim ra'a tachat tova. That the brothers of Yosef treated him horrifically, but he treated his brothers properly. Yaakov treated Esav properly, took care of him, and Esav treated him terribly. Makadosh Baruch Hu Yavo Yosef. Davar Acher, Esav tinef atzmo ba'areyot uvishvichut damim. Esav dirtied, sullied himself with sexual sins and murder. V'Yosef gider atzmo min avira uvishvichut damim. And Yosef protected himself from sexual sins and from committing murder. Right, when he runs away, he says to his brothers, oh, you thought that I would do something terrible to you. That's not the case at all. Esav wanted to kill his brother, but Yosef menachem etachav, and Yosef comforts his brothers, and he gives them food. Vizanam, he gives them mazon, food, v'kilkalam, he takes care of them financially, v'yinachem otam, and he comforts them. Davar acher b'malei k'tiv v'lo yirei Elokim, v'yosef k'tiv et Elokim eno yirei. By Esav it says they didn't fear God, and Yosef says I fear God. And then at the very end over here, it quotes v'yihi beit Yaakov esh v'beit Yosef lahava, and it goes and it quotes our verse that we had read before. And then it says, "Imsarei kol shvatim yochlu saros shel Esav lisav litan." Esav's spiritual angelic power can fight with all the brothers. Avolim Yosef enim yochlum latzil nafsham lahava, but Esav cannot protect himself from Yosef. Va'arun v'chur tamchu biyadav, Arun b'schut akuna, v'chur b'schut hamalchut. So what I said before, that who are the characters over here? We have Yosef below, who's able to fight against Amalek, who's the grandson of Esav, if that wasn't clear. And then we have Aaron, who is going to be Kohen one day, and Hur is the man who should end up being king. At the very end, he quotes a verse, when Esav disappears, Echad Omer, Timched Zech Amalek, Ad Shelo Pashut Yodob Yerushalayim. Okay, we'll leave it at this, and let me explain what it is that we just now read and what we just now saw and what we really should understand. What the Psikta told us is that the fight against Amalek is really a struggle. Yisrael and Amalek is really a struggle between Yaakov and Esav. And when it comes to Yaakov and Esav, Esav has some complaints. You stole the bracha, you stole the bechora, I was hungry, you know, you took my birthright. And which, by the way, Esav was very happy about. And Esav has this ability to complain on a moral level against Yaakov. And that works till he meets Yosef. I'm saying in this imaginary meeting. Esav's going to come and say, my brother did terrible things. Yosef's going to say, what did he do? And he'll say, well, he gave me food when I was hungry. He goes, okay, my brother's trying to kill me. Yosef will say, well, how do you pay him back? He goes, well, I tried to kill him. And Esav will say to Yosef, how do you pay them back? He goes, well, I took care of them for around 80 years. I gave them food, I gave them clothing, I gave them shelter, I took care of them. Which means Yosef's morality ends up being what allowed us to be victorious against Egypt and made the sea split miraculously. And it's Yosef's morality which allows us to be victorious ultimately against Amalek. Which means even though, you know, we keep on thinking that the story of Bereshit is over, and that, you know, as much as I like Yosef, and maybe you can tell that I do, that's over. I can't keep pulling him up, but what can I do if he keeps showing up again? Yosef keeps showing up because at the beginning of the parasha, he shows up. How does he show up? That beautiful contrast. The Jews have all their weapons with them, but Moshe takes the remains of Yosef. All the weapons are not going to help, but the remains of Yosef are going to help. And that's what we learned in the Mechilta, that the sea is going to split because of the remains of Yosef. And that means ultimately the most potent weapon they have with them is the remains of Yosef. When they travel through the desert, there's this midrash that says, how in the world, they had two aronot with them. They had two arks. One ark contained the Aseret HaDibrot, the Ten Commandments. And the other ark contains Yosef's remains. And it says, how could this, there's a dead body, how could be this next to that? And the Midrash says that God says, I hereby attest that the one who's in this box kept every single thing which it says in the other box. And you go through the Ten Commandments, Yosef keeps all of those Ten Commandments, and God says he has every right to be there, which means Yosef's remains have a right to be there. When it comes to fighting against Amalek, Moshe understands the dynamic. He takes the leaders, and the true leaders, he takes the one leader, and that's his brother Aaron, who one day be Kohen, puts him right next to him. He takes another leader who one day will be king, Hur. He puts him next to him. He then sends Yehoshua down. And it's interesting that he's already called Yehoshua here. That extra letter is there. Yehoshua from Yehosef, next to him is Hur, from Yehuda. This idea of making God manifest in the world and making God's name complete, Yud, Hey, Vav, we just need that last Hey, in order to make God's name complete, his throne complete. But as long as Amalek is in the world, fighting against acknowledgement that God is king of the universe, we have a problem. And when the Jews question God's existence, that's when Amalek arrives. That's when we're most susceptible. Our lack of belief, our lack of faith, our lack of trust is what makes us susceptible to Amalek. So now who better to send down to fight than the descendant from Ephraim, Yehoshua from Ephraim, from Yosef, from the tribe who had the most faith, from Yosef, who's able to be somebody who fears God. Esav doesn't fear God. He fears God. He's somebody who does the moral thing all the time. And ultimately, the victory of Am Yisrael against Amalek, which is led by Yosef, which is led by this flame, the flamethrower, if you will, which is in the hands of Yehoshua, it all comes from this incredible amount of faith, of emunah, and therefore it's a moral victory. So Am Yisrael go through the desert and we start our trip. We're on the way to the land of Israel and we're going to be taking lots and lots of detours along the way, far more than we can possibly imagine. But we already learned in this week's parasha certain elements which are going to need to happen. Ultimately, it's Yeshua who's going to lead us into the land of Israel. Yeshua is going to represent something which is called Mashiach ben Yosef. He is the one who's going to do all the heavy lifting. And then after he does all the heavy lifting, then ultimately we get to this point when Mashiach ben David comes, somebody from the descendants of Yehuda, from Hur, Yud-Heh-Vav, Yehuda, Yehosef, Yud-Heh-Vav, that they're the ones together who are going to be able to create a situation that Mashiach ben David comes and then a ben David comes and builds the Beit HaMikdash, which means compressed in this parasha are all the elements. Belief, morality, knowing that we need to lift our heads heavenward, not to get too taken away with ourselves and think that it's we, kochi v'yadi asu atachai lazeh, that it's my hands that are going to be victorious. We find is that Yehoshua goes down to fight. He's the one who could be victorious, but Moshe's on the mountain pointing heavenwards. And who's the one who supports Moshe? Aaron and Hur. What is one of the most horrific scenes in Jewish history. At least according to the Gemara, one of the most horrific scenes is that moment when Hor says, stop, no golden calf, stop. Moshe is coming down from the mountain soon. And they stand up and they execute Hor. At that point, Am Yisrael is at the lowest possible moment. But nonetheless, we're able to pick ourselves up from that. So we realize now that this is not going to be a quick trip to the land of Israel. It's going to end up taking a lot more time than we possibly imagine. There's going to be lots of stops along the way. And God attests we're not quite ready yet. But in order to be ready, there are certain people along the way who are going to lead us and tell us what to do. And ultimately, the message is going to be the same, that we need to lift our heads heavenwards and realize that our food that we have, the water that we drink, the food that we eat, and the lives that we have are here because God has given them to us, and we need to recognize that. Sometimes we can lift our heads up, our eyes up by ourselves. Sometimes we need someone to point us and Moshe to point, and sometimes even Moshe needs somebody to hold up his hands and to give Moshe strength, as it were, and that's Aaron and Hur. But sometimes we also need somebody there to fight. And the one who can fight better than anybody else because of the moral victory is somebody from the tribe of Yosef, and that is Yoshua. As far as the long trip that we're going to take, we'll continue that next week.